This podcast brought to you by the English Department at Florida State University.
Kate Kimball on a stage to introduce our first reader for the night, who is Jesse Goolsbee.
Okay, Jesse said to keep this short and sweet, so I'll do my best. I first encountered the voice of Jesse Goolsbee in the form of a haunted soldier who spent his time addressing a special needs child who had been strapped with explosives and later run over by a large army vehicle. The soldier oscillated between accusing the child and giving endearing sentiments, almost in the patrimonial form, and reflecting on his full life as a husband and father, forever changed by the killing of a young girl. The soldier, of course, was human, and with that came the enormous weight of coming to terms with his shortcomings, the way his service to his country had forced him to make the impossible decision of killing another human being, even though that someone else was a weapon of mass destruction. As the narrator ruminates over this difficult experience in his life, I was struck by the level of realism Goolsbee employed and the way that the man was shown with strength and pride, but also with tenderness and humility, qualities that Jesse Goolsbee also possesses. It may be tempting to cast Jesse Goolsbee as another war writer, but I sincerely hope that this particular label is never soldered permanently to his profile, because Goolsbee manages to write about so much more than war, and that label, ironically enough, seems a little limiting. But perhaps that is simple naivety. Tim O'Brien, perhaps one of the most well-known war writers, said that, quote, "War is hell, but that's not the half of it, because war is also mystery and terror and adventure and courage and discovery and holiness and pity and despair and longing and love. War is nasty. War is fun. War is thrilling. War is drudgery. War makes you a man. War makes you dead," unquote. Later, O'Brien said that, quote, "Fiction is the lie that helps us understand truth," unquote. I quote O'Brien in reference to Jesse Goolsbee because Jesse's work is so much more than combat. In fact, I have yet to read a full combat scene in a piece of Jesse's writing. And yet his characters are constantly combating the plight of service, its dangers, its allures, its lies, and the constant strife to retain a sense of normalcy. Goolsbee uncovers the hell of war, but also the hell of human experience, of loss, and love and disconnection from others, the innate and inevitable loneliness, and Goolsbee manages to do this without resorting to illusions of grandeur, sentimentality, or sensationalism. The rawness of human experience is always present in his writing, and he isn't afraid to show aspects of life that may make readers flinch. Because of this, Jesse Goolsbee is one of the most generous writers I have ever met. In his new novel, I'd Walk With My Friends If I Could Find Them, his three main characters all must confront a conflict in their past history of warfare and find ways to live inside the damage that they were personally responsible for. These characters aren't heroes, as Goolsbee doesn't cast them as such, yet what they face requires a specific level of courage. Goolsbee does not shy away from complicated aspects posed by his writing, its many queries of nobility and social correctness, and manages to immerse a reader inside a world that is both intriguing and earth-shattering. Goolsbee's novel was longlisted for the Center for Fiction's First Novel Prize. His fiction and essays have appeared in Narrative Magazine, The Kenyon Review, Epic, Salon, The Greensboro Review, among others. He has received numerous awards, including the John Gardner Memorial Award and a C1E Fellowship and the Hainbridge Center for Creative Arts and Sciences. Goolsbee earned an English degree from the United States Air Force Academy and a master's degree from the University of Tennessee. In addition to those fine accolades, Jesse Goolsbee has great enthusiasm and interest in supporting other writers. He gives great comments on colleagues' work and always offers support in other ways. His novel is also available for purchase in the back tables, and Jesse, I'm sure, would be happy to sign that for you if you're interested in purchasing this great book. You would be a fool not to purchase it. A truly gifted writer, let us please welcome Jesse Goolsbee.
How's everyone doing? It's great to see you tonight. Thank you, Kate, so much, and thank you, Nick, for allowing me to share this evening with you. This will be the last time I get to read here at the warehouse, which is kind of heartbreaking, as this is my last year at Florida State. And I didn't want the opportunity to pass without thanking some people really dear to me in this program, and many of them are in the room. And I'm not going to name names, but there's many staff and faculty here and peers and friends that have become like family to me. And I'll start crying if I talk too much, so I'll make this short. But I just wanted to thank you from the bottom of my heart for your time and your kindness and your generosity over these last 2 years. It's meant a great deal to me. Tonight I thought I'd read two pieces. The first one is a standalone flash piece, and the second one is the first 5 pages of my novel. And I hope you all are in a wonderful mood, because these are a little intense. You ready? Here we go. This first one's called Feed. I'm going to feed you. I know you don't want me to, but I'm going to feed you. I'm going to push this tube down your nose, down into your stomach, and I'm not gonna lube it up, because I want this to go slow. I want you to feel me at work, and I see you there, shackled to the chair. I saw you squirming before I came into the room. I watched you through the little window in the door. You were twitching and sweating, trying to convince yourself you were somewhere else, maybe in your cell, maybe back home. And when I walked in, I could tell you liked me right away. A woman, you thought. Easier. And I saw you relax because you were worried it might be some rough and tumbled blockhead marine, but no, you got me. And you think that I'm going to go easy on you. You're guessing that I don't want to be in Cuba either. These shitty hot summer days, but you were wrong. I want to be the one that keeps you alive. I want to be the one that forces food down into you. I want to prolong your life. And 2 minutes ago, you had an empty room. You had fading hope that you'd starve to death. Gorgeous martyrdom. But now you have me. And I'm going to keep you alive. And I'm going to give you a minute. I'll let you think that you have a woman who is going to take it easy on you, a weak woman here to comfort you, to talk to you when I thread that pipe down your nose. Maybe you'll think I'll whisper to you like your mother used to do. Maybe you think I'll tell you it's going to be okay, that it'll be over in a minute, but that's not what you're going to get. You're getting a dry tube shoved down into your stomach, and you're going to gag. You're going to beg me to stop, but you won't be able to speak. You'll only give me a whine and a gurgle, and I'll ignore you. And you're shackled tight, and I'm going to show you this bottle of Ensure so you know that you're getting the good stuff, the shit with all the calories that will fatten you up for life. And I see you looking me up and down. Hi, it's me. And you don't know it yet, but I'll be here tomorrow and the day after that. We'll just hit repeat on this feed, but let's start today, right now. And you can watch me pull the little cover down on the window and the door and walk toward you. Take another few moments to breathe deep. Feel that stale air enter your body. Scan around the room and look at those white cinder block walls. Breathe deep and look back at me. Yes, here I am. I'm going to feed you. I know you don't want me to. Take this nod. Think about what it means. Wish for your mother's voice in my throat. Take these seconds and breathe. Think about your hunger strike. You and your buddies sending a message. Yes, good. Give me the scowl. Go ahead. You want me to know you're a tough guy, but take a moment and think about the days you've gone without food. You and your buddies trying to get our attention, and you've got it. And here I am, ready to fatten you up. I'll keep you alive. Yes, you see that bottle. Yeah, speak to me. Chant at me. Let's get religious. Show me your soul. Sing to me. Turn it up. Keep it going. Pray for salvation. Sing the devastation of facing more days on this earth. Chant at me, tough guy. Keep it going louder. I hear you. You want another nod. I know it. Pray at me. Close your eyes. Sing me back to South Chicago. And my son, you think that's where I want to be. But know that I can wait, at least a little longer, because I want you to live. Already I'm studying your nose, your nostrils, which one I will choose. Yes, I'm checking you out, this woman, you think, who will speak to you as your mother did. This Marine, she doesn't want to be here, but I'm here. I chose to be here, to hang this bottle, to puncture it with one end of the tube and ready the other end between my fingertips, and I'll tighten your restraint first. Let me get close to you. Think of me. Smell me. Calm yourself. You're going to live. I'm going to feed you. I'm going to control you. I hold the tube in front of your eyes and you quiet down. Yes, this is going into you. Take this nod. This will hurt. Feel the tip in your left nostril. I'll leave it there for a moment. It tickles. Feel the tip in you, just barely into you. Think about how you'll fight it, how you'll feel the dryness all the way down, how you'll gag and beg. You'll squirm like you're dying, but I'm saving you. The insurer hanging beside us is your savior. I'm here. Feel the tube in your nostril. Feel it start down, dry, slow. Feel it catch, and I'll push harder. Let's take our time. Feel the plastic enter you, curve into you. Try to call out, I'm here. Feel the plastic catch on something deep now. I push again and you spasm. Let me hear that groan. That tube deep, and with the other nostril you smell me. Smell the soap from my shower. Smell my breath from my breakfast. Shake those limbs and test the shackles. Yes, test them again. That pipe sliding down into you, the pain and pressure, and yell at those cinder blocks at the summer heat. Yes, we're here together, and you're ready for the good stuff. White and thick, working into you. You fight it, but you're not going anywhere. No one is waiting for you. And there it is. You feel it in your sinus first. The coolness trickles deep. Go ahead, cry out. You'll live. And I'm the reason. Fight it all you want. The liquid seeps into your body, healing you. It's me, yes. Look at me, right here. Take this nod and think of what it means. Feel me touch your arm and listen to me. Calm down. Hear my voice as I speak to you. These are the only words you'll get. Calm down and listen to me say, I'm saving you. How are we doing? A moment of levity might help. My novel, I'd Walk With My Friends If I Could Find Them, came out in June. Kate did a great job of introducing the book. It's really about people trying to find connection and find themselves, not just in the traumas in conflict, but the traumas, the service, and the love of our domestic lives. It's really about just being human, and what does it mean, and how do we showcase the courage of waking up every day, getting dressed, and just trying our best? You don't have to be a veteran for that to be heroism. There's a type of beautiful liberty and courage in just getting up and trying your best. What the three protagonists experience in the book is quite varied, but the one thing they have in common is a deep yearning to try to find moments of repose in a world where there are no guaranteed moments of repose. I'm going to read the first four pages. The first chapter is called Be Polite, But Have a Plan to Kill Everyone You Meet, which is a real Marine saying. All right, here we go. Wintrick Ellis, newly arrived, pushes his size 8 boot into the spongy ground and feels the subtle give of the earth run through the ball of his foot, up his leg, and settle in his camouflaged hip. Green grass in Afghanistan, he thinks. Water somewhere. He smells damp soil and grass, unexpected but familiar. Little League center field. Kristen in a California meadow. And attempts to make this thick-bladed greenery stick alongside the everywhere suck-you-dry desert he had imagined. Eyes open, everyone, Big Dak says. Although Wintrick knows today is a low-risk humanitarian mission, the words slide him back into his default visceral nervousness. Bombs. Somewhere. Everywhere. Already he has been told that roadside means nothing in this country. Big Dax and Torres have shared stories with him, everything from far afield livestock to massive diesel trucks igniting the barely buried hell. Not to mention the bombs strapped to men, women, children, dogs. Bombs the size of tennis balls, soccer balls, tackling dummies. Under the rising sun, Wintrick replays the refrain repeated among his platoon for each of his 8 days in country. Don't go looking for a fair fight. Wintrick watches the relaxed movements of the most experienced soldiers and he feels his body breathe. He pulls out his knife and crouches in the valley amid a mist of gnats. He plunges the blade into the soil and levers up a clump of grass. Silently, he rises and collects his first sample of war in a plastic bag that he fists into a cargo pocket. Nearby, a group of mangy goats bleat in a grove of white-blossomed almond trees, their shepherd talking with the interpreter. For the first time since Wintrick arrived, the wind doesn't howl, and he wonders if any kind of omen awaits in the warming air. But he pushes the thought from his mind when he can't think of a single positive forecast, the size of tennis balls, soccer balls. He breathes and rubs his eyes. The shepherd laughs and nods and moves his hand to the interpreter's shoulder, then hugs him. 10 minutes till the party starts, Big Dak says. Going to be hot. Hydrate now. Wintrick observes the men start toward the small mountain of bottled water. Torres passes by and slaps his shoulder. Drink up. Wintrick isn't thirsty, but he keeps his mouth shut. When they say drink, he drinks. He straightens up, pats his cargo pocket, and steps and stops. He looks back at the straightening grass and watches the indentation of his boot print disappear. 10:30, and the children and limbless adults are starting to arrive, and Wintrick scans the group heading his way, wondering if he'll be the one ordered to pat them down before the inoculation and prosthetic limb giveaway. He pushes his index fingers into his temples, then removes his camouflage blouse and tosses it on the hood of the dusty Humvee. Big Dax and Torres have been decent enough to keep him out of trouble for his first week, but they outrank him. And each only has a few months left, so he knows he'll soon be the one palm to body with these incoming strangers. Wintrick studies his two superiors as they watch the arriving crowd, Big Dax towering and thick-shouldered, brick of a chin, dark, random freckles, and Torres, slim and handsome, black hair, sideburns, flat nose, hands interlocked on the top of his head. Ellis, Torres says, check 'em, old ones first. Wintrick nods and slowly walks over to the now settling group. The interpreter has his arms up, directing traffic, shouting at the dirty and quiet kids to stay in a single-file line along an outcropping of beige rocks. The adults are told to wait behind. On his short march over, Wintrick focuses on the adults, most missing a foot, a leg, or a portion of an arm. Light layers of clothing shield their bodies from the late morning sun. Various pant legs and shirt sleeves hang limp. He will have to touch all of these people. Before Wintrick begins the pat-downs, the interpreter says, don't touch ass, crotch, easy with kids, no problems here, medicine here. You know these people? Wintrick says. No. So you don't know shit, 17 pat-downs later, Wintrick comes to a man who seems whole, tiny sweat streams around his eyes. "Thank you," the man says before Wintrick has touched him. Wintrick glances back at the interpreter, who nods, then shakes his head. "Excuse me. No problems here," he says. "What's he doing here? He's not missing anything." "No problems. God damn it. Thank you," the man says. As with the others, Wintrick starts with the man's shoulders, pats down his arms to his wrists, up his sides, down from his clavicle chest to his belly, where Wintrick feels something bulging, soft, ball-shaped. He pauses for a moment, and when the bomb vision arrives, he whirls around, head down, and sprints. In the slow-motion frenzy, he hears the man yell something, sees his own arms reach out in front of him, and he knows he will die, right now, that the searing blast will take him from behind, open up his back and skull, liquefy his body. He is all heartbeat and screams, "Bomb!" takes two more strides and dives to the ground. Behind him, the man has lifted his shirt up to his neck, baring his torso, pointing at the fleshy protrusion. "Nah!" the man yells. "Nah! No!" the interpreter says. "No, please! Nothing, only..." He pauses. "Skin! How do you say?" Wintrick lies face down in the grass. Eyes closed, body flexed. He hears "skin," and pushes himself up on his elbows. Big Dax and Torres run toward him. "Crazy cells," says the interpreter. Wintrick still hears his heart in his ears, and he squeezes his hands, then opens them. He cut his left hand during the dive and wipes the fine line of blood off on his pants. He stands, still dizzy, and peers back at the man who cups the ball of flesh below his ribs. Wintrick shakes his head and glances down at his palm, where fine dirt is mixed with coagulating blood. "God damn," Big Dax says. "Deep breath, Alice. Breathe." Big Dax touches Wintrick's arm, but Wintrick shakes him off. From the side, the children laugh. "Cancer," Torres says. "That could be cancer." "Ah, yes," says the interpreter. "Cancer." Thank you very much.